Okay, everyone. Tonight is April 11th. It's the last class of this, I guess you call it a semester before Pesach. Welcome to all who are listening live and those who listen after the fact and who email me. I do want to announce before we begin that if anyone's still looking for summer activities, I'm running the trip to Spain. Trip to Italy. Spain is starts the end of June into July. The trip in Italy is at the end of July, and the new trip, the second week of July or end of the first week, I have to check the calendar, is a trip to Germany, which I'm preparing it right now. And if any of you know of people who are looking for an interesting Jewish history trip, please recommend it to them. Okay, let us begin. This is obviously just the first class of we'll have to continue when we meet again. We're moving on to a new figure, that of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. You see him in the picture there, as I'll show you other pictures as well. This is a famous one from after he went to Jerusalem, where even the non-Hasidic rabbis would wear the shtreimels in Jerusalem. But he's far from Hasidic, as we will see. He is. One, when you speak in terms of the Rosh Yeshiva, the heads of yeshivas in the 20th century, he has to be on any list of the great Rosh Yeshiva, especially if you look at those who in the post-war years, although he did not live that many years in the post-war years, if you take, let's say, 1950, he would be a senior, if not the senior. I would say actually he would be the senior Rosh Yeshiva in the world. In 1950, he has also a different connection, being the father-in-law of Rav Aaron Cutler, as well as being a very important individual in his own right, as we will soon describe. One who differed with Rav Aaron Cutler in a number of areas, he was much more positively inclined towards Zionism. Without any further ado, let us begin. And as always, I mean, you can send in questions, but I'll go to about 10 minutes to 10, and then I'll take the questions. So, Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer was born in 1870 in the city we all know, Mir, a city in the in Poland, although in larger Jewish Lithuania. And his father was, he comes from a family, his father was a respectable Torah scholar, not of the top level, but a respectable Talmud Chacham with ties to important rabbis. In his youth, he studied in he studied with the local rabbi in Mir. Let me show you. I'll pull it up right here if I can find it. The name of the rabbi is Yom Tov Lipman Bassianski. That's how it's usually pronounced. He's the author of this work that you can see right here, known as the Malbushe Yom Tov. There's a second work. An earlier work, the Malbushe Yom Tov, which was published by Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, the famous Tosfos Yom Tov. I don't know today if anyone really, other than people like Rav Ovadia Yosef, if they study this work, but this was a sign of a rabbi Baslavsky, you say. Okay, I thought it was Bassianski. Not even mentioned on the title page. I'm just doing this from memory. Thank you for that. As it says, you notice there, it says Chone b'Kilat Kodesh Mir Yarum Alav Elokim. That's when it says Chone Chaf Nun Hey. That becomes the. That means he's the rabbi in Mir, and then it tells us that he was rabbi in other cities. And if you look at the second one there, Chaslovich. Chaslovich. For those who know the history of the Soloveitchik family, that name should be familiar to you because. That was the second rabbinate of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik spent a time in Chaslovich. That was all the stories you've heard about his Malamed, the Chabad Malamed, who taught him Tanya instead of teaching him Talmud, and all the other stories, checking the Erev, things like that. That comes from Chaslovich, which was a Chabad city, but they had a tradition of always hiring non-Chabad rabbis. In Jewish circles, this rabbi, Malbushe Yom Tov, is just known as Rav Yom Tov Lipman, And that's where he early that's what he studied with him in his early years. When he was a young man, 14 years old, he traveled to it's 1884. He traveled to the great yeshiva of Volozhin, which at that time, although there were other yeshivas, Slabodka just started, and you had the Mir yeshiva actually, so you don't need to go that far. The Volozhin yeshiva was the greatest, and this was quite young. 14 years old is a young age to be admitted to the Slabodka yeshiva. We have other examples of that. He had a family connection to the Netziv, so that might have helped. A few years after this, there was the famous Mecheter Eloi, Rav Shlomo Palachek, and he famously was admitted to the Volozhin Yeshiva at only 12 years old. He had his bar mitzvah as a student at the Volozhin Yeshiva. I don't know of any other examples. This is, as far as I know, the only example on record of a student having his bar mitzvah at the Volozhin Yeshiva. If you were that young, you didn't go away to yeshivas, and you had little yeshivas, like Rav Chanan Wasserman's type of yeshiva, like a high school sort of thing. So that was quite unique. We've spoken about the Mecheter many times, Rav Shlomo Palachek, because he then comes to, he's the first Rosh Yeshiva really to come to America not to raise money, but he was hired by Yeshiva College, Yeshivas Rabbi Tzvi Elchanan, and he dies young. I don't want to repeat the stories, which I've said numerous times. I'll just add that he has family in Israel. There's also a Sol I was looking for a picture before, and there's a Solomon Palachek in America, which must be the family. But he has descendants in Israel, and the Sfarim have been reprinted. And to this day, people who read the Chidushei HaIloi Mimechit say that I've seen online people say it's really top of the line. And supposedly, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik regarded the Mecheter Eloi as his greatest student. The fact that Rav Chaim was a big anti-Zionist and the Mecheter Eloi in Rav Chaim's lifetime was very much a Zionist, Mizrahi, taught at the Lida Yeshiva, shows you that the open-mindedness in those days in Lithuania, that you could differ from your Rebbe, even in such a fundamental thing as Zionism, where Rav Chaim was not just an opponent. He was the leading rabbinic opponent of Zionism, and yet his leading student, the Mecheter, was an avowed Zionist. Getting back to the Mecheter, when he had his bar mitzvah in Volozhin, we have testimony how he gave his drasha, his rabbinic drasha, his bar mitzvah drasha, in the presence of both the Netziv and Rav Chaim of Volozhin. Getting back to Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, it is often said, you'll find this said numerous places, that he, during his time in Volozhin, he was a member of the secret Zionist society called Nes Tziona. There was a secret Zionist society of students because although the Netziv was what we would call, I wouldn't call him a Zionist, as we had classes already. Oh no, we didn't have. We had on Rabbi Yitzhak Khan. We'll have to do classes on the Netziv. He was, I wouldn't call him a Zionist. I would call him what we call one of the Chovevei Tzion, a pre-Zionist lover of Zion. He didn't really live into the era where you have the issues of political Zionism, but there was, even in the early years when the Netziv was around, you did have, I mean, it was the beginning of Zionism, and you had a secret society. The Netziv did not permit anything other than Torah. He was not opposed to secular studies, but he didn't believe it should be in the yeshiva. When he did put secular studies in Volozhin, it was because he was forced to by the government. He didn't want anything other than Torah in the yeshiva, and that included any of these organizations, Zionist organizations, or even organizations which he'd have no opposition to. And I don't think he had any opposition to Nes Tziona. Nes Tziona, in theory, was just a religious organization to settle the land of Israel. It wasn't really political. So Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer is often mentioned as being a member of that. His good friend at the time, later to be his brother-in-law, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, was a member of this. He's recorded as being a member. There's a whole book on by a man named Klausner, Yisrael Klausner, who also wrote about Vilna. And Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein's mentioned. He's mentioned elsewhere. If you look at There's a you can see this on if you have Otzer HaChma, the Encyclopedia of Religious Zionism. Mossad Rav Kook published this Encyclopedia of Tzionut Datit. And if you look, there under Avishai Zalman Meltzer, it tells you that he was a member of Nes Tziona, and this is probably based on the research of Rav Moshe Tzinovitz. Rav Moshe Tzinovitz was a rabbi, but also historian of the Lithuanian yeshivas, and he wrote a good deal about the Lithuanian yeshivas, and he claimed, and he's the earliest example I found, that Rav Moshe Zalman was a member of this Zionist organization. And yet, I don't know if it's true, and I don't really, there's no evidence for this, despite the fact that Moshe Tzinovitz, who had a lot of information, and I guess he's reporting a something he was told, but if you look at his grandson, Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer's grandson book on him, it's not a, it, I wouldn't call it a hagiography, I'd call it a, well, it's not a hagiography, it's really a collection of stories. But Yehuda L. Meltzer, who is a Zionist, he comes from a Zionist family. His father, it's Yehuda Meltzer, they were real Zionists. If Yisro Zalman Meltzer was a member of Nes Tziona, he would have mentioned that. At least if he knew about it, he would have mentioned it in the book. He mentions all the other things. Furthermore, if you look at Yisrael Klausner's book, Nes Tziona, it's a whole book on this underground religious society in Volozhin. Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein's mentioned, others are mentioned, but Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer is not mentioned. And Yisrael Klausner, I mean, he knew the topic. He wrote a book on it, and he knew all the people who were in this secret society. And when he wrote this, Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer was, he was a legendary figure. The fact that he didn't mention it means he didn't know it either. So that leads me to believe that there is no evidence, and there's no reason to say that Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer was a member of the society. I know I'm the religious Zionists might not be happy at what I'm saying because I'm, undermining one of their great claims. That Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer was a member of the underground society. It's enough that Rav Moshe Mordechai was a member of the society. There's no evidence that Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer was a member. I think because Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer becomes identified with a positive view towards Zionism, and in fact, in Agudas Yisrael, Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer is one of the most positively inclined to Zionism. And because Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, who he was brothers-in-law with and was so close to, was well known as a member of the secret society, therefore Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer becomes attached to it as well on the assumption, well, he too must have been part of it. But as I said, there is no evidence whatsoever. Meir Bar-Ilan doesn't mention it, and Meir Bar-Ilan wrote about Volozhin. Since I mentioned Meir Bar-Ilan, let me tell you a story that he states in. He wrote two books that are relevant. One is a biography of his grandfather, of his father, the Nitziv. The Nitziv was married twice, and from the first marriage, he had the famous Rabbi Chaim Berlin, whom the yeshiva is named after, and then he got married a second time. And you can check me, correct me if I'm wrong. Rav Chaim Berlin was, I believe the number is 48 years older than Meir Bar-Ilan. So very, very big difference. But Rav Meir Bar-Ilan, Meir Berlin, in his earlier years was Meir Berlin, obviously knew his father, and he wrote one book on his father. Hold on, I might have it here. Actually, I don't see it here. I thought I had it. And then he wrote a book, which was more not just about his father, but discussed all sorts of things. He wrote it in Yiddish and later into Hebrew. I can't remember if he wrote translating to Hebrew or someone else did. From Volozhin to Jerusalem. It's a little surprising that it hasn't yet been translated into English, but he tells the following story, and which relates to Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer. He tells it. Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer is a side person in the story. Is his point of telling the story is to tell you about his father, Rav Natalis Yehuda Berlin. But the story is of interest also with regard to Rav Moshe Zalman Meltzer, because the story is that Rav Moshe Zalman once said to someone who we don't know who it is, Meir Bar-Ilan doesn't tell us, obviously, because he doesn't want to, he reflects poorly on this person. He calls him the Masmid, the one who completely devoted to his Torah study, day and night. Hamasmid, that's the title of Bialik's famous poem, a legendary poem in which he portrays the life of the Lithuanian Torah student. So it says in the Tziv, turned to the Masmid and says to him, "You learn Torah." Obviously, he's a Masmid, he learns Torah. And then he says to Rav Isser Zalman, "And you know Torah." So what's the difference? If you know, so he explained this to the Netziv, explained to his son, Meir Bar-Ilan, what's the difference between this guy who learns Torah and Rav Isser Zalman who knows Torah? He said that from well, he explained it to him as follows: by turning to sorry, by turning to he turned to the Masmid and explained, and that's how Meir Bar-Ilan understood. He said, "From all your learning, you don't have any time to be a Lamdan, to be a real scholar." He says, "When you stop being a Masmid without eating and drinking, you know, this guy would hardly eat and would hardly drink, he would hardly sleep. He's every moment of the day that he was only devoted to that." He says, "When you stop being such a Masmid, then you'll be able to learn Torah." Basically, what the Netziv was saying to this Masmid, and I'll just show you what he said to Rav Zalman, is, and this is a theme which was stressed by certain Musar teachers, including the Alter Sabbatka and others, is that with all this learning of Torah, you have to be normal. You have to be a normal person. You often hear it saying in yeshivas, they'll say about this guy, he's a genius or he's a great gadol, great Talmid Chacham, but he's normal. What it means is he's normal. I've heard it said about Ramosha Feinstein. I had someone on my trips a couple of years ago to Europe who was a student of Ramosha Feinstein, and he said the thing about him that stood out was he was normal. And people who don't know what it means to be in the yeshivas, yeshiva world, they won't know what that means. What it means, normal. What kind of thing is to, how is that describing someone? But anyone who's spent time in yeshivas, you know that a lot of these geniuses or a lot of these people who know a lot are not normal. They're eccentric. They have all sorts of we. They can't deal with people. And partly that's why maybe they focus on the book so much because they can't relate to individuals. They're not really social beings. They're very unusual. Look, we spoke about Revel Yashiv. Revel Yashiv was not able really to relate to individuals. He was not a people person. That everyone has written the biography describes how he didn't like to talk to people. So when you speak, so the Netziv was saying, stop with all this. You know, don't getting no sleep, no eating. He was saying, when you stop, let me read it to you again. Because of all your learning, you don't have time to be a lamdan. When you stop being a masmid, then you can begin to know Torah. I guess because to become really a lamdan, you have to be a complete person. It's not just enough to be a book person. And then he continues. Meir Bar-Ilan continues. Sorry, and this is quoted by Rav Isser Zalman's grandson, and he says that my grandfather, he accepted the Netziv's approach. What's the Netziv's approach? Lomod b'shas halimud. That is when it's time to learn, you learn. When it's time to sleep, time to eat, then you sleep and you eat. So he wasn't regarded as a masmid, but he was regarded as one of the great students, and he was unusual in that if you look at the memoir literature and see what was going on in Volozhin at the time, there were the two Rosh Yeshiva. You had the Netziv, and you had Reb Chaim, and each one of them had their students. Rav Isser Zalman was almost unique in that he was in the camps of both of them, and he was admired by both Reb Chaim and the Netziv, and he felt close to both of them. You had some like Rav Kook, and he was a minority, who were with the Netziv. In fact, the Netziv did not have many students. Reb Chaim overshadowed the Netziv. When you think of the great students in Volozhin, really they were in Reb Chaim's orbit. The Netziv, I often say, if Netziv were to come back now and want to give shiur on Ramban or Chumash, things he would do, you know, all of Lakewood and Muncie, everyone would come. You couldn't get a space there. But in his day, who was listening to him? I mean, they weren't interested in listening to his shiurim on Chumash, and he had wide ranging interests. The Netziv. He studied halachic midrash. He studied the shiltos of Rav Achai Gaon. He studied all sorts of things that were not. He wrote commentaries on, not just on Chumash, on books of Nach. That was unusual, and that appealed to certain people. Rav Isser Zalman among them, but not many others. Since I just mentioned Rav Achai Gaon, let me tell you something interesting. In Rav Mazuz's part, his new parsha sheet. If anyone's interested in a very unusual Parsha sheet, different than any of the other ones out there, of what it includes, you want to sign up for this. but he mentioned he was talking about Tanis Bechorim. Last week's, I think it was last week's. He was talking about the fast of the, which is coming up next week, the fast of the firstborn. And he, by the way, rules halacha lemaaseh that all you need to do, if you complete a not just an order of Mishnayos, but complete one masechta of Mishnayos, that's enough, and you can eat. And he's talking about the history, and he says, you know, if I'm not mistaken, he says the very first reference to it is in Rav Chai Gaon, in the Shiltos, or maybe he's referring to something else where Rav Chai Gaon mentions it. And then he has a footnote where he says that Rav Avadya Yosef used to refer to Rav Eliezer Waldenberg in his writings as Rav Chai Gaon. And someone wrote to Rav Avadya Yosef that he doesn't understand why he refers to him as Rav Chai Gaon. Rav Chai Gaon wrote the Shiltos. He didn't write the Tzitz Eliezer. And Rav Mazuz says, you know, this is a foolish person. He doesn't know that Achai Gaon means Achi, my brother, the Gaon. So you say this about someone you're close to. Moshe says that Rissa Zalman famously criticizes total devotion to Rav Chaim's approach. We will get to his relationship to Rav Chaim and his method of learning soon. Actually, not today, but we'll get to it. When Rav Isser Zalman was in Volozhin, this Rav Kook was there as well, but this was the era in which the Maskilim had a great influence. You had many enlightened people who were there, and there are many stories of people during this time period who were influenced by the Maskilim. There's no evidence that this had any influence whatsoever on Rav Isser Zalman, although maybe it did have some influence because he does come out with an open-minded approach, but we don't have any record, any stories, and he was a very close student, as I said, of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. He remains in Volozhin approximately 7 years, and then he goes to Radin, the school of the Chafetz Chaim, where he learned for one more year. Following that, he returns to Volozhin, and it wasn't long after that that he marries. He marries a woman named Bela Hinda, who was the daughter of an important man, an important figure, named Shraga Feivel Frank. He was a wealthy Talmud Chacham, a student of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter used to use his attic. Sometimes Rabbi Yisrael Salanter used to do what they call today, other than the Breslovers, who does it? It's called Hitbodedut. You know, to be alone. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter actually did it. And so did Rabbi Yitzhak Blazer, the student of Yisrael Salanter. I don't believe the Altar of Sabatka did this. I'm going to have, by the way, stay tuned. Very soon I'm going to be publishing interesting unknown material about the Altar of Sabatka. But we know that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and we know that Rabbi Yitzhak Blazer did this, you know, Hitbodedut, where they spend time by themselves reflecting. This Shraga Feivel Frank was no longer alive, but in his will, he said that his daughters, he had three daughters, if I recall, should marry, no, four daughters. He had four daughters. He said that, or at least four daughters that are known to have married great figures. He left in his will that his four daughters, who were not, or his daughters, were not married yet, should marry Talmidei Chachamim. And they did. One of these daughters marries Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. We'll do classes on Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Slabodka Yeshiva, and later the Chevron Yeshiva in a recent post, I wrote something about him as well. Another marries Rav Baruch Horovitz. Most people won't have heard of Rav Baruch Horovitz, but he taught in Slabodka. He wasn't the Rosh Yeshiva, but he taught in Slabodka. He dies in 1936. Another marries a man named Sheftel Kramer. I mean, this is also a name that's totally forgotten today, but Rav Sheftel Kramer was Mashgiach in the, that is spiritual, not Mashgiach of the food, Mashgiach over the souls, spiritual guy, Mashgiach in the Slutz Yeshiva, and later comes to the United States. His son-in-law was Rav Ruderman. Think about Rav Sheftel Kramer. His I don't know if any of you have any connection to the family. It goes through also to the Neubergers. They're related to him. Rav Shechtel Kramer was in Slabodka. He was what we call the older Bacher, or I don't know if he's that's the technical term. There was an idea of an older Bacher in Slabodka, that an older Bacher like looked out for the younger Bacher, learned with him. In fact, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was the older Bacher of Rav Aaron Cutler. He was older than Rav Aaron Cutler. So I don't know if Rav Shechtel Kramer was older than Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. He had a certain type of relationship. I don't know if it was a quasi-official one, but Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg sent letters to Rav Shechtel Kramer, and in volume one of the collected writings of Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, I published some of these, and they're Torah letters. There is another letter which the family has, which they wouldn't give me. In fact, the person who has it from the Neuberger family said, actually, there's two letters. One, he read part of it. He didn't give it to me. The other, not at all. He said he asked the Shiloh whether he should give it to me, and the answer was no. And I even offered to drive down to Baltimore and just read it after my book appeared. So I'm not going to have nothing to do with it anymore. I can't include it. And he says no. I couldn't even do that. And he asked him why not. And he said, hey, look, he's very nice. He gave me three other letters, including a letter from Yechiel Weinberg to Rav Zalman Meltzer. When I published that in the volume, everyone was shocked, because here you have Rav Yechiel Weinberg as a young man. This is like the earliest halachic letter we have of his to Rav Zalman Meltzer. The words he gave me, what he said was, it's voyeuristic. So it's voyeuristic. He didn't explain what that meant, but I know what it means. This was the era that Rabbi, if you read my biography of Rabbi Weinberg, you know that when he was in the Slabodka Yeshiva, he was torn. On the one hand, he was like so many others. He was being pulled to the Haskalah. He had contacts in that world. And on the other hand, he was also being pulled to the Torah world, and he could have gone either way. And I have no doubt that these letters are letters in which he opens up his soul to Shechtel Kramer. You know, which direction should he go? What should he do? Rav Aaron Cutler also. I mean, you had that. There was, unlike Rabbi Weinberg, in which there were maskilim. There's a maskil and kovno named Baal Machshavas. He was a Yiddish writer, Isidore Elyashiv, who tried to, you know, was friendly with Weinberg. With Rav Aaron Cutler was his sister, who was trying to convince him to leave this old-fashioned world where you're not going to amount to anything. And by the way, to the end of Rav Aaron Cutler's life, she never had any respect for him. And that, if you look in Kamenetsky's book, you see it. She thought he was just a Melamed, and she would tell him, you know, you could have been a professor of mathematics or things like that. She thought he wasted his life, and yet he would come visit her in the old age home, even though she was completely irreligious. But he would always show her great respect and great kavod. And this is a fact, and we have eyewitnesses here today. But there's a biography of Rav Aaron Cutler, and they write about how he was always, you know, gave so much respect to his sister, and they portray his sister as a religious woman, which is, not only was she not religious, she was anti-religious, like of the old anti-clerical type of Jewish communists, you know, hated religion. But he always showed great respect for her. These letters to Rav Shechtel Kramer, I still haven't given up hope. One day I hope to see them, because I think they're important, and they even if I don't write about them. So that's Rav Shechtel Kramer. He married the other daughter. He becomes When he comes to America, he becomes a Rosh Yeshiva in Cleveland. There was a yeshiva set up by a man named Yehoshua Heschel Levenberg. Rav Moshe Feinstein also was there for a short time when he came. And then in 1930, he sets up with his son-in-law, Rav Ruderman, a yeshiva in New Haven. And then, you know, that doesn't last. And then, you know, Neir Yisrael comes about. So, and the fourth daughter, Rav Zalman Meltzer, married. I don't know who made the shidduch, because the father wasn't alive anymore. I don't know if it was a brother or something, but obviously they were able to find four important Torah scholars, and they had the money to provide, because it was a wealthy family. And if you wanted to get, you know, a good Talmidei Chachamim for sons-in-law, you had to be able to support them for a time. This daughter, however, Bela Hinda, I don't know if she was at all similar to the other sisters, because I haven't heard anything about them, and I assume not. But she was a very special woman, very unusual. in that she was Jewishly educated in an era before Beis Yaakov, in an era where, really, to be Jewishly educated as a woman, the only way this could be done is if you were taught by your father, or if you just happened to pick it up on your own because you were a genius. I don't know how you'd pick up a Hebrew reading. There were young girls who sometimes went to the cheders, but Ramosha Feinstein's family even mentions it. If you look in the introduction to not the last Igros Moshe, the one before that, where they discuss the biographical introduction, it mentions that the cheder Ramosha went to, there was a girl in the cheder, but that doesn't get you to become a very learned woman. We have some learned women in Eastern Europe who wrote in Hebrew, who wrote for the Hebrew Orthodox press. But these were people who must have, like Yentl, must have been given instruction by their fathers. Let me read you what Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer writes in the introduction to Volume 3 of his book, Evan HaAzel, which is his work on his magnum opus, his commentary on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. The Evan HaAzel, it's an expression from the Book of Shmuel, if you remember. I believe it's when David is with Yonatan and he's shooting the arrows or something. He says to him to stay, you know, stay by the stone, the Ezel stone. And that's the, but Ezel, look at the abbreviation, Isser Zalman. That's where he gets it from. We say, in the Pasuk, it says Azel, because it's a Sof Pasuk. It's the end of the Pasuk. However, people have criticized me, but I grammatically I'm correct. If you're just speaking, you don't say Evan Azel, you say Evan Ezel, I think. It's not in a pasuk. It's like Gashem. That might not be such a good example because there's a big dispute whether it should be Gashem or Geshem in davening. But Gashem, if I'm just saying, for example, if I'm saying rain, and I'm just speaking, I would say Geshem. But if it's a verse, a biblical verse, at the end of the pasuk, or even in the middle, end of the first half, when it ends, you say gasha. You say gafen. That's the way the Hebrew language works. But if you're speaking, you never say it that way. And therefore, I say, and I insist, and people have corrected me, and I say that I'm not wrong. I say to them, you're wrong. I'm right. If you're speaking, you shouldn't say Evan HaAzel. You should say Evan HaEzel. Because the name of the rock is Ezel. It just so happens at the end of a Sof Pasuk, it becomes Azel. Just over Shabbos, I had a case like this, because I was speaking to someone. My son's bar mitzvah parsha is Bamidbar. So I'm trying to arrange a teen minion. So even though my son, it's not this year, it's the following year, but he's going to do the Maftar and the Haftarah, which can be done by under bar mitzvah. My other son is going to do Rishon. And I'm not going to be here on Shavuos. It's the third day of Shavuos, so we have to arrange it. So someone said the name of the parsha is Bemidbar. And I said, actually, no, it's not. The name of the parsha is Bamidbar. It begins, it says Bemidbar Sinai. So since it's Bemidbar, since there's the word Sinai, therefore you can't say Bamidbar. So you have to say Bemidbar Sinai because the stress goes afterwards. But if you're calling the parsha, if you take out Sinai and just call in the Parsha Bamidbar, or you don't say Bemidbar, you never can say Bemidbar by itself like that. It's the name of the Parsha is in the desert, so it's Bamidbar. As you can see, I have a bit of a fixation on these grammatical points. So getting back, though, to what appears in Rav Isser Zalman's Evan HaEzel, he says as follows. It's not in the introduction to Volume 1. I don't know why. You'll find this in the introduction to Volume 3. It could be that Volume 3 came out first. I forgot to check that. It's the Volume 3, but that doesn't mean that it came out third. It's those. But he says, I want to give a special blessing, bracha miyuchedet, to my wife, the Rabbanit. Rabbanit here means Rebbetzin, Marat Bela Hinda. You have some people today, they're so pious, they won't mention their wives' names. But he mentions his wife's name. the daughter of Harav HaTzadik HaNadiv, that means the great philanthropist, Chaim Charles Frank, we see right here that this is the third volume. He says, she has a chelek, a portion, in in addition to this volume, but in the first and second volumes also. Why he didn't mention her in those volumes in the introduction, I don't know. But he says that she has a share in these volumes, because in addition to her great efforts, Bishmirat, you know, in watching over my health, however she did that, and from keeping away from me all tirdachit sonit, which means all the trouble, external trouble, which could mean, you know, when you have people like Rizam, when you have all these shamils and schnurs who come knocking on the door to make trouble, and you need to have a good wife there telling him that you can't come in, or otherwise he'll never get any learning done. And then he says, so in addition to all of that, the entire work, kol avodat hasfarim aleha, the entire work of the production of the book, his sefer, is on her. She is the one that encouraged me to print already the first volume by removing all the difficulties in putting out such a big volume. How did she do that? By getting the money. He's saying that she raised the money. She must have spoken to important people who have money. The gam hetika bichtav yadekol kitvai umas shamid. For she also copied all my entire manuscript. He had a typical rabbinic hand, not very neat. You can't give that to the printer. When the printer gets it, he has to be able to read it to set the type. Bela Hinda copied over the entire manuscript in a nice, beautiful script. I've even seen, if I recall, an example of a page of the Evan HaEzel in her handwriting. And she was involved with the production, the printing, and the hafatza, that is the spreading of the book, making sure it got to all the book dealers. And because of that, because she was involved in all of that, I had the ability to devote myself just to my studies, and God should reward her, etc., etc. We should have nachas from our children. There are stories that say that when she'd be copying over his pages, things wouldn't make sense to her, so she'd go to him and say, I don't understand this, and based upon what she said, he would correct what he wrote. I don't know if that's true. I'm not sure if she actually understood what she was copying. There's no evidence that I know, at least in print, that she was a rabbinic scholar like we have other women are, but she was no doubt more involved than the typical, this is a legendary, it's famous, that she was so involved in the publishing of his work to an extent that I don't know of any other rabbinic wife who spent the time and the effort that she did in with the book. The most that they get when they thank their wives is that, that they helped me. Look at Rav Avadia Yosef. He says that she helped raise the children so I was able to focus on the writing, but not that she had anything to do with the book itself. So this is unique, and it's of interest. Returning now to Volozhin, after his wedding in 1894, when Rav Isser Zalman is 24 years old, he is appointed a teacher in Slobodka, in the Knesset Yisrael yeshiva. There's two yeshivas we know in Slobodka. There's the Musar yeshiva, Knesset Yisrael, and then there's the other yeshiva, Knesset Beis Yitzchak, which was run by Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, which was the non-Musar yeshiva. The yeshivas split. He was then, I want to show you, I don't have it here. It's upstairs. I'm reading it. This Shlomo Tikashinsky, this new volume just came out on the Slobodka Yeshiva. Great, great stuff. And the picture on the front of it, you've seen the picture, those of you who follow the blog. It says, it really gives you, in fact, let me pull up this picture, because this has to be seen to be believed. Let me get the picture here. I'm not going to take the time to find it on my computer. I'm just going to pull up the website, and then I'm going to share my screen with you. It should do the trick here. Here you go. That's a picture, and these, I can tell you who these people are if anyone's interested. This is, it's Lamdanut Musar Elitism. It's Torah scholarship, Musar and Elitism, Yeshiva Slabodka from Lithuania to the Land of Israel. It just came out 2 months ago, but this picture says it all. Look how these guys are dressed. Look at these spiffy dressers here. That's how they dressed, and this was all in accord with the, and when it came to Israel, no less a figure than Rav Kook was all upset with them because in his yeshiva they dressed more traditional with their beards and other things. And here, look at how these guys are dressed. It was all in accord with the Alter of Slabodka's approach of what he called Gadlut Adam, that you're a yeshiva student. You're not a batlan, as they call some lowly person and that people need to look down upon and feel like you're a nebuch. On the contrary, you're the top of the top, and therefore you have to dress like $1 million and you have to feel like $1 million because you're studying Torah, and that's the most important thing. And these are the pictures. You do not have anything like that anymore. And I wrote, if you want to look, you can see what I wrote, but I said the word elitism is important because these guys that you're looking at, this was not an era where many people went to yeshiva. It was a small group, and they felt like an elite. Even if, and there was a time when Jewish society as a whole regarded them as an elite. Already by the 1920s, much of Jewish society is far removed from traditional Torah learning. But in the Orthodox world, and they felt themselves as part of an elite. So here you have a wonderful book full of new information on the Slabodka, not just in Europe, but Slabodka, which is the Hebron Yeshiva in the land of Israel. So let me now get back to my screen here. Question is, how do I get me back here? Okay, there we go. Let me pull up Rav Isher Zalman so you see him again. So he's appointed a Ram. That is a Ram, a Rosh Masifta. It means a Rebbe. Unlike YU, in which all the Rebbes are called Rosh Yeshiva, that wasn't that. I don't know where that custom comes from. Usually, you have a Rosh Yeshiva, or if you have a Machokas in Yeshiva, you'll have a two Rosh Yeshiva. But you have a Rosh Yeshiva or two, and then you'll. I shouldn't say only. Look, Gush Etzion has maybe four Rosh Yeshiva. Now they used to have two, but in general, you have a one Rosh Yeshiva, two Rosh Yeshiva, and then you have a lot of teachers. And YU, for some reason, every Rebbe is called a Rosh Yeshiva. That wasn't the way it was in Slabodka. You had Ramim, they called them, and he was appointed a teacher. At the same time, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, his brother-in-law, was appointed, supposedly. You never can document these sort of stories, but supposedly he only wanted to appoint Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer, but Rav Isher Zalman was able to prevail upon the Alter of Slabodka, Nosson Sweet Finkel, to also appoint Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. Now, one of Rav Isher Zalman Meltzer's students in Slabodka at this time was someone who also came from Volozhin, namely the Mechitor, Shlomo Palachek. And not everyone realizes, who knows about the Mechitor, he also was at Slabodka for a short period of time. This appointment of Rav Isher Zalman and Rav Moshe Mordechai at Slabodka together did not last long. I should say, actually, the appointment of Rav Isher Zalman didn't last long. It only lasted 3 years because at that time, the Ridbaz, Rav Jacob David Wilavsky, known as the Ridbaz, not the Radbaz, from Sutsk and then Chicago and then Sfat, we had classes, I think four classes on the Ridbaz. If you haven't heard the old classes on the Ridbaz, I encourage you to listen to them. Very fascinating figure. He writes to the Alter of Slabodka asking the Alter to send him a Ram, a Rebbe, and some students to, because he wants to open a yeshiva in Sutsk. And Rav Isher Zalman is offers to be the Rebbe, and he goes to Slutsk. And he didn't go by himself. He brought 14 students with him, and they are known as the Yad HaChazaka, the hand, the strong hand. Yad, Gematria is 14, like the Mishnah Torah called the Yad HaChazaka. because there's 14 volumes. Some people didn't like the fact that the Rambam referred to the code as the Mishnah Torah, so they came up with a different term, Yad HaZaka. We went through who these 14 were when we did the classes on Rav Reuven Katz, but some of you might not remember or weren't with us, so let me read you the names again of these 14, the Yad HaZaka, who went with Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, to sent by the altar to study in Slutsk. The first, well, I'm just when I say the first, as I told you last time, there's this book Ohalei Shem, a book of rabbi, it lists all the rabbis and everything from the early part of the 20th century, and it lists the numbers, the names. But we have listed elsewhere as well. The first is of Laser Yehuda, he's called, or Eliezer Yehuda Finkel. In the yeshiva, we're called Laser, the son of the altar of Slobodka. Someone who, by the way, was very close to Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, even studied together with him. They went to Mir. The altar of Slobodka later would send Laser Yehuda Finkel to the Mir yeshiva because they also wanted students. They wanted actually Musser type of students. So he went there. But the Laser Yehuda Finkel was a great Talmudist, unlike the altar, by the way. I'm curious to see whether what I'm going to write about, the information, if people are going to be upset with it. I don't think why they should be upset. It's known among anyone who knows anything about the yeshiva world. Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg speaks about the altar of Slobodka, and he mentions that he wasn't such a great Lamdan. He knew how to learn, but he wasn't such a great Talmudist. And he says some other things. I don't know, people might get offended. I can't see why. Everyone knows that the altar of Slobodka was not a great Talmudist. His field was Musar. But still, today, you know, when you say he's not a great Talmudist, he's not referring to compare, let's say, to your local rabbi today. But if you compare him to the Rosh Yeshiva of his day, that wasn't his thing. So I don't think that's insulting at all. And the Sri Deyesh, when he says it, didn't mean to be insulting. He just was describing who he was. Therefore, the altar had to bring in great Rosh Yeshiva. And Slobodka had the greatest Rosh Yeshiva. Ramosha Mordechai was only one of them, but later he becomes Rosh Yeshiva. At this time he's not, but the names of the people who taught at Slobodka, I mean, this is the top of the line. So the first one, Eliezer Yehuda Finkel. The second is one, his name is Rafal Shmulevitz. I don't know who he is. He was a Horovitz, but I don't know. I assume he's related to the Shmulevitz family, the famous Shmulevitz family. He was this Shmulevitz. He taught in Navardic, and there was a place called Stutchen, which was a Musar yeshiva in Navardic as well. Rav Yosef Konvitz was the third. He becomes the son-in-law of the Ridbaz. He even lives in Sfat with the Ridbaz. And then he comes to Newark. And he is the leading rabbi in Newark for a number of years, and he even wrote a volume of responsa, which they published. Masada Rav Kook reprinted it. Yosef Konvitz. His son is Milton Konvitz, who was a famous political scientist. I don't know how observant Milton Konvitz was, but he was somewhat observant. If you look in the letters of Rabbi Soloveitchik, the question about using an interfaith chapel, which Rabbi Soloveitchik deals with at great length, was addressed to Milton Konvitz. It had to do with the Cornell University interfaith chapel, and it was. And Konvitz inquired of Rabbi Soloveitchik if that would be appropriate. Then you have Shlomo Yehuda Leib Puchensky. There was a great Rabbi Puchensky, a son-in-law who passed away a few years back, a son-in-law of Rabbi Aryeh Levine. It must be his father or grandfather. Moshe Yom Tov Wachtvogel. He becomes rabbi in Canada, but I don't know the relationship to the Wachtvogels, the famous Wachtvogels. The next is Pesach Pruskin. He actually later becomes the Mashgiach of the Slutsk Yeshiva. He has to leave the yeshiva. You can't have two kings with one crown. Why do I say that? In the new volume, Mesoras Moshe, which is from Moshe Feinstein's oral comments, it just came out a couple weeks ago with the second volume, he talks about Pesach Pruskin, because Rav Moshe Feinstein went to the Slutsk Yeshiva when Pesach Pruskin was there, and he studied there for a number of years. And then he left and went with Pesach Pruskin to the next place he went to, and he's the one, Rav Moshe was the one who mentioned, that you can't have, the rabbis tell us you can't have two kings and one crown. But Pesach Pruskin, a well-known figure. The seventh is Reuven Katz. Reuven Katz, later rabbi in Lithuania, rabbi in Bayonne, New Jersey, Petah Tikva. We got classes on him. The eighth is Yitzhak Rubinstein. Also a figure we've come back to again and again, Yitzhak Rubinstein, who happened to be a very big Talmud Chacham, but a Mizrahi rabbi. He is known in Jewish history as the one who, even though the tradition in Vilna was there was no official rabbi, ever since the days of the Machlokas over the Vilna rabbinate that happened around the times of the Vilna Gaon, there was no official rabbinate. The community wanted a rabbi, the Mizrahi wanted a rabbi. And even though Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski was the leading rabbinic figure by far in Vilna, they didn't want Reb Chaim Ozer because he was not a Zionist. He was an Agudist. Also, there are people who thought that Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, because during World War I, he left the city and he didn't stay there and stay with the people. They thought, well, he's a great Talmud Chacham, but just because he's a great Talmud Chacham, he's not a rabbi. A rabbi has to stay with the people. And Rubinstein, during World War I, even though it was very difficult times, he remained in Vilna. So they elected him, and it was a huge controversy. The Chafetz Chaim got involved because it was viewed by the Agudists as a great slight to the honor of Reb Chaim Ozer, and not just by the Agudists. A member of Reb Chaim Ozer's Beis Din was the famous Chanoch Henech Agis, martyred in the Holocaust, the author of the great work, the Bar Cheshes. He was on Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski's Beis Din. He was the second most important rabbinic figure in Vilna, I think you can say. And he was Mizrahi. But yet he resigned from the Mizrahi when the Mizrahi decided to support Yitzhak Rubinstein. But Yitzhak Rubinstein was one of these eight. It's an old story. Had Yitzhak Rubinstein not joined Mizrahi, he'd be in the canon of Gedolim of the Aguda. The ninth is Baruch Rabinovich of Tavrig. I don't know about him. Then comes Rav Lipman Rutskin. Again, I don't know who he is. Moshe Yom Tov Hachtman, rabbi in a small town. I don't know him. And another of Shlomo Henech Maram. I don't know who he is. And then this a bachur named Menachem Mendel Luntz, who died young. Again, I don't know anything about them. These figures, but those are the Yad HaChazaka. So they open, they come, and they establish this yeshiva in Slutsk, and then he names Rav Isser Zalman names the yeshiva Eitz Chaim. Why did he name it Eitz Chaim? Eitz Chaim happens to be the official name of the Volozhin yeshiva. Very few people know this because, just like I was at a wedding last night in Teaneck. Those who know New Jersey. You know the Romer Shul. So I don't know what the official name of the Romer Shul is. It obviously has an official, must have an official name. Romer's the street, I think it's on. Romer's the street. So I don't know what the official name is, but it has an official name. And you have examples like that. Same thing with Volozhin. Everyone knows it as Volozhin. I don't know. Mir Yeshiva must have an official name. I don't know what the official name of the Mir Yeshiva is either. But in any event, so that's he calls it Eitz Chaim. One of the Keter Torah, Moshe saying Keter Torah is the official name of the Mir Yeshiva. Okay, I didn't even know that. I haven't investigated the Mir Yeshiva so much, but look, I've been reading Torah literature for decades now. I don't think I've ever seen the name mentioned. You have a number of shuls where you don't know what the official name is. And then you have shuls where it's not clear what the name is. If you remember that post about the shul in Harrisburg, is it Keser Torah or Keter Torah? Or Kesher, sorry, Keser Israel or Kesher Israel? You're saying Romer shul is Keter Torah. Okay. That I knew, actually. Not to say that I knew that. But I don't know. Does the Mir Yeshiva have a name? It must have a name. If anyone knows, let me know. One of the early students of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer in Slutsk was Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, also a very important figure about whom he had classes on as well. He learns in Slutsk for 6 years. He had a very close relationship with Rav Isser Zalman, and he became the American representative of the yeshiva. And I have here a very interesting letter which Rav Henkin, well, Rav Yisro Zalman responds to Rav Henkin. He doesn't give him the answer I think that Rav Henkin wanted. Oh, I already see it's already 9:56. So let me read the letter because I don't see there's no questions really. So let me finish up with the letter here, and then we will I'll go back to look at some of the questions. Rav Henkin was already in America, and I'll make a mark that we'll pick up here next time we come back. Rav Henkin was already in America, and he already had begun a quest which would take him for 3 decades to put forth this idea that civil marriages, this later also goes into reform marriages, but civil marriages are halachically binding. I'm not sure why Rav Henkin was so convinced of this and why he wrote so much about it, including great argument with Ramosha Feinstein, because there were great rabbis who thought otherwise in his day, obviously great rabbis afterwards. But he wrote to Rav Yisro Zalman Meltzer because there was a rabbi, a Hasidic rabbi named Zev Tversky. I don't know who Zev Tversky is. I don't know where he falls in this Hasidic dynasty. But what did this Rabbi Zev Tversky, he was not known as a great Torah scholar, but he wrote an article in the Jerusalem Rabbinic Journal called Kol Torah, again, proving that, or arguing that civil marriage does not need a get. And Rav Henkin was upset with this, and he wrote to Rav Yisro Zalman Meltzer, and he also wrote his own article about this in response to the same point that was said. There was a rabbi in St. Louis named Chaim Fischel Epstein, and unlike Tversky, Chaim Fischel Epstein was a really well-known Torah scholar from Lithuania. He published a number of volumes. You can see in HebrewBooks.org. Rav Yisro Zalman Meltzer, be sorry, Rav Henkin begins his article, which also appeared in Or Torah as follows. When I came to this country, that is America, I found that this ruling, this heter, that civil marriages don't require a get, had spread wide, and therefore I published my book, Perushei Ibra, in which I claim that a woman who's married civilly, she's Eishes Ish Mina Torah, she has the status from the Torah as a complete marriage, and if she doesn't get a get, it's adultery. And he says, I gave proofs for this, and now that I see that in HaPardes, they're printing, this is, must be Chaim Fischel Epstein, he's printing also a this heter, I have to again repeat my position. So he wrote to Rav Yisro Zalman Meltzer, asking Rav Yisro Zalman Meltzer to join his quest, join his crusade against the civil marriages. And this had become the standard view. The standard view was that civil marriages do not require a get. And Henkin, although he thought he was correct, and he thought he had great proofs, one of the proofs was she responds with a rivash, if I, as I recall, dealing with a couple who was married in a Catholic ceremony, that is Maranos. And he assumes that this is a valid halachic marriage. So he writes to Rav Yisro Zalman, and Rav Yisro Zalman replies, that which you've asked me, he says, about as a civil marriage, why haven't rabbis protested what Rabbi Zev Tversky wrote? He calls him, he doesn't call him a gaon or anything like that. Rav Yisro Zalman refers to him as a Rav Reb. That means, like a secondary rabbi, not a great Torah scholar. Great Torah scholars, you call them gaon, the second, just a typical rabbi who writes something, you call him rabbi. And Rav Yisro Zalman says, until you wrote to me, I didn't examine the matter. And now that you've, and we'll see, Rav Yisro Zalman was not into practical halacha. That's something we're going to deal with next class. He says, now that you wrote to me, I've looked at it briefly, and I don't find any thing in Zev Tversky's, Rabbi Zev Tversky's piece, anything different, anything new from what was said by Hagaon Rav Chaim Fischel Epstein. So Rav Chaim Fischel Epstein, he's already a Gaon b'Torah, and I don't know what's so surprising here, and why you're making this a big deal. He said, "Umitzad ha'samchut ha'toratat I don't know what you're getting all uptight about, sir. Vicious Ahmed says to him, "What? Why are you making a big deal? We already know what Rechayim Fishel Epstein says. What are you making a big deal that Rabbi Zev Twersky writes something? Ha'im bishvil shu megezad morim v'utzat admar. He says, if what? Because Rabbi Zev Twersky comes from a line of Hasidic rabbis, and he's a bit of tzad admar, a shtickle admar. He's a bit of a Hasidic rabbi himself, and he's also known as a tzaddik. Is that because of that? That he writes an article, who Yoter Bar Samcha Mahacha Meirav Hagaon Merachayim Fishel Epstein? Are you going to tell me that just because he's a tzaddik and he comes from Hasidic roots and a bit of a rebbe, that now he's more authoritative than Merachayim Fishel Epstein? In other words, Rav Yisrael Meltzer didn't understand why Rabbi Henkin is writing to him and saying he should protest and examine this matter and protest what Rabbi Twersky is writing. Well, who cares about Rabbi Twersky? Why is that authority? We already have Chaim Fishel Epstein. If you want to protest, protest against what the great Torah sage did, not the fact that he's a Hasidic Rebbe. That doesn't give him any authority in terms of halacha and psak. So that's the first thing he says. And then he goes further and says, if you want me to get involved in this dispute, he says, it's very difficult for me to get involved in this because I know from Russia, there was a great rabbi in Russia, David Katzenelnbogen of St. Petersburg. David Katzenelnbogen was the last rabbi in St. Petersburg. We don't really have much in the way of writings from him, just a little, but he was considered a great, great Torah scholar, and he permitted civil marriages to be broken without a get. He was the rabbi under the communists. When the and he says, how then can I? He says, you can protest, you can lepakpek, you can disagree with this ruling, but how can I get involved and make a ruling la'asot dorot mamzerim? He's saying to Rav Henkin, which others said as well, if your ruling is correct, then all the children are of the new marriages are mamzerim. So why do I want to get involved with this, especially when in Russia you had such an important figure? And he says that Rabbi Katzenelnbogen dealt with all these cases when the with the communists, that is, when the Baal was a communist. You know, you had all these cases where, you know, the family, they're both communists, they're not religious, and they're married, and now the marriage is over, they get divorced, the husband's a communist, he's not giving a get. And Rabbi Katzenelnbogen said, and he's deciding for basically all of Russian Jewry under the communists, that you don't need to give a get, and therefore, and he says, v'imamnam, even though I know that the iser, the prohibition of an eshet ish, is very severe, chamor ma'od, nevertheless, ain't a davar pashut etzli, he says, I'm not convinced that you're right. It's not, I'm not convinced that they need a get, and therefore, you know, what value will come if I investigate this matter? And he says, even if I investigate this matter and come up with a responsum that it's forbidden, yavo acher v'yistru, others are going to come and disagree. This is already a big dispute, so I don't need to get involved. And then he says, and hasn't the Ramban Nachmanides already told us in the introduction to his Talmudic commentary? Nachmanides famously says that when it comes to Torah disputes, there's no absolute proofs. He says it's not like mathematics, where you can prove something. When you're dealing with svaras, when you're dealing with logic and how you read a sugya, you're never going to be able to have a slam dunk or an actual proof. What you're going to have is, I guess we say, the preponderance of the evidence, where you know, it's almost impossible for the person who disagrees with you to retract, but others will see it and, you know, you can make a good case. But what Reza Solomon is saying, that this isn't something that you can prove. You're always going to have people disagree. What's the point of going ahead and writing a response to declare that all these children are mamzerim? And even if I do, because who says that's the halacha? And even if I investigate it and I come to agree with you, Rabbi Henkin, what's that going to accomplish? Because you have great rabbis on the other side who are going to differ. So he's not giving Rav Henkin the answer he wants. Now, I'm not going to continue. When we return, he will continue because he quotes Rav Yitzchak Hanan and he speaks about the situation in America. We'll pick up with this when we return, this letter. But let me deal with some of your questions or comments here. We're just beginning with Ravisher Zalman. The best is yet to come. Let me just whet your appetite. When Rav Aaron Cutler decides to throw out of the yeshiva, literally expel out of his yeshiva, he takes over Slutsk, a student, because he becomes a Zionist and wants to be involved and go listen to Zionist speakers. Whose house does he go to live in? He goes to live in Ravisher Zalman Meltzer's house. So there'll be some interesting material. Bill points out that Rafal was one of his sons of Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. So yeah, so it must be, you'd have to investigate this. Maybe Rav Chaim Shmulevitz was the son of Rafal Shmulevitz that I mentioned, one of the Yad HaChazaka. It could be easily, while we're waiting here, I'm going to tell you right now who it is. How do I know? Because I go to Wikipedia, and yes, lo and behold, he's born 1902 to Rafal Alter Shmulevitz, the son-in-law of the Nevardik Rosh Hashiva, the Alter of Nevardik. So that's exactly who it is. Chaim Shmulevitz becomes the Mir Rosh Hashiva. Moshe points out where they went, Moshe says, regarding women involved in publication of Sfarim, two examples come to mind is Chaye Aryeh from Yisrael Salanter's son. That I didn't know. And a sefer called B'nai Tzion. B'nai Tzion is Lichtman, Ben Tzion Lichtman. So that must be his wife. There's some other examples where the women were involved in the publication. One that comes to mind is Zecharia Yalas's Hatorah V'Hachayim. If you look there, no, not that one. Sorry, Kol Kisvei Zelger, Yitzhak Zelger. I think that's his first name, Yitzhak, which has Haskama of Rav Kook. It was published by the widow. The Rav. The question is, what did the Rav say about the Interfaith Chapel? He says he's very much against the Interfaith Chapel. That we don't have interfaith chapels, that there has to be, and this would cost money because they have to build another one, but each faith community is unique and has to have their own building, because otherwise you water down the differences between the faiths. He wasn't giving up psak if, let's say, you're in an airport and there's an interfaith chapel, could you use that? He was simply talking about could lechachila ab initio. Could the Jewish students share their synagogue with Christian, Protestants, Catholics? And that Rav Soloveitcher was very opposed to. Those who travel out of Newark, United to Israel, on that right next to the Starbucks there's something called an interfaith chapel. So you might want to go in to Dauphin or something, but it's definitely, they call it interfaith chapel. If you walk in, there's Christian things on the wall there. So I don't really consider that an interfaith chapel. An interfaith chapel for me would be something that has nothing in it. If they want to bring in their stuff when they have their services, but you next time you're in the airport, take a look. It's right terminal, United Terminal C on the by 130, those numbers, right at the beginning when you make the right turn down, right next to the Starbucks, you'll see the interfaith chapel. Check it out. You'll see. Moshe points out, Rav Tzair said to Rav Chaim Fishel Epstein that he was only this only serious learner in the Kovno Kolel, and he also argued on Rav Simcha Zelig Rieger's Pesach on fridges. Yes, and he understands, if you look, that's the early response. He understands Rav Simcha Zelig the only way to understand him, that it's the electricity. It has nothing to do with the lights. It's in his book, I think it's called Shuva B'Halacha. I didn't know, or I didn't recall, because I read Chaim Rav Tzair's autobiography that he mentions Chaim Fishel Epstein. Anyone who, if I ever do the book, which I won't do, but if I ever did the book on the history of American Orthodoxy, I do it very different than Jeffrey Gurok, I would do it, I'd try to show also the rabbinic development. Truthfully, maybe I should do that. I'm looking for a project now. I would use the writings. Chaim Fishel Epstein's writings are very valuable because they speak about early 20th century, problems. Yeah, people like him and Hershenson and others. Shuva Shlema, yeah, thank you. Okay, so that's is that it for us? Yeah, Benicio. Oh, David Shapiro. Okay, I was. There's another Ben-Zion Lichtman has a number of volumes on Shulchan Aruch, also called that. This Rav David Shapiro you refer to, he's known for one thing in particular, and that's the Dateline. For some reason, he became his viewpoint on the international Dateline was taken very seriously. He was an expert on the Dateline. Okay, everyone, thank you all. Have a very nice Pesach, and we'll pick up, I guess, after Pesach. Good night, everyone.